Welcome to Consilience, an African science podcast, brought to you from Johannesburg, South Africa. Consilience is a weekly podcast dedicated to promoting reason, skepticism, and a scientific worldview in Africa and beyond.
Welcome to Consilience. Today is May the 7th, 2011, and I'm Owen Swart. Joining me today are Michael Meaden.
Hello.
And Angela Meaden.
Hey, everyone.
Starting off with teaching Angela to appreciate history.
On May the 7th in 1952, the concept of the integrated circuit was first published by Jeffrey Dummer. The integrated circuit is the basis of all modern computers. It is made by diffusing trace elements, such as copper, into a thin substrate of semiconductor material, such as silicon. These circuits are used in all digital appliances, including computers, cell phones, cars, microwaves, the whole shebang.
Not in Apple devices, though. I think they use an abacus or some such.
Little demons.
Wearing turtleneck shirts of some kind.
Yeah. Right, of course, yes.
Moving on to the news, no listener feedback this week. So, as you all know, on May 2nd, Osama bin Laden was shot and killed by a group of US Navy SEALs in Abbottabad, Pakistan. Wow, 2011 is really turning out to be the biggest news year in quite some time. We've had tremendous amount of stuff happening, you know, bin Laden being killed, the Japanese quake, the Fukushima disaster.
The hurricanes in the USA.
The supermoon.
Oh, yeah, the supermoon.
That's the biggest news story of the year.
Of course, nothing happened with the supermoon. Anyway, let's just ignore that. Anyway, so we don't want to get into the politics or anything like that about the Osama bin Laden killing, but there are a couple of fascinating critical thinking and skepticism angles to the story. And the first one is just a beautiful example of bad thinking that bin Laden has been guilty of for quite some time. You know, saying bin Laden is guilty of bad thinking is a bit like saying the Pope is irrational, you know, well, duh. But anyway, the specific example that I'm going to give is, I think, just beautifully illustrate the fallacy of confusing correlation and causation. So if you've seen Rambo 3, you probably know that in 1979, the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan. Now, this inflamed the Muslim world, and thousands of Arab and other Muslim volunteers were soon fighting the Soviets or providing support to the fighters. And this included the young Osama bin Laden, who wasn't really a frontline soldier. He was sort of a background organizer, and he used his daddy's billions to just support the fight generally. And he was a bit of an organizer. A lot of these Arab groups, the Mujahideen, were funded by the CIA, although bin Laden himself, as far as I know and as far as the documented records go, was not funded himself directly. So the Americans, because it was the Cold War and they were trying to undermine the Soviets, they were giving these fighters things like Stinger missiles to bring down Soviet aircraft. For reasons we need not get into, the Soviets lost, or at least failed to win, this war, and withdrew in February 1989. The year 1989, of course, was monumental. It was the year in which Eastern Europe finally overthrew their Soviet-backed communist regimes. So that was the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia, the Polish uprising, and all the Eastern European countries that for a long time were dominated by the Soviets and forced to remain communist countries because of what was called the Brezhnev Doctrine, which was any country that's communist will be kept communist by the Soviet Union with force. And this was replaced by the Sinatra Doctrine, jokingly named for "they're doing it their way," which was Gorbachev's response to the Eastern European revolutions. And then soon after that, in 1991, the Soviet Union itself was dissolved, ending the Cold War. So you have the collapse of communism in 1989 and the defeat of the Soviets in Afghanistan in 1989. And amazingly, Osama bin Laden convinced himself that he personally, along with these bunch of Arab fighters, were responsible for the collapse of communism and the collapse of the Soviet Union. Because it makes sense, you know, they forced the Soviets to withdraw in 1989, and they started in 88, and then suddenly the Soviet Union collapses. Correlation equals causation, therefore, Osama bin Laden was personally responsible, at least to some part, in bringing down the Soviet Union. This is what he believed. It's a classic correlation and causation fallacy, coupled with a big dose of the self-serving bias. because it's pretty clear the Arab fighters themselves were not a military factor. It was the Afghan soldiers themselves that defeated the Soviet soldiers, not the couple of thousand Arabs. They helped, but they weren't decisive.
So it's like if I brush my teeth and immediately after that Robert Mugabe dies, I then convince myself that my brushing my teeth killed Robert Mugabe.
If only.
One can only hope.
So this is the same fantasy that somebody might make if they are feeling ill and they happen to be provided a homeopathic preparation. Afterwards, they stop feeling ill and they attribute that feeling better to the homeopathic preparation. Even though there's no direct causal link, they think that because happening A followed happening B, that B caused A.
Post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy, yeah. And it's also, as Owen mentioned a couple of episodes ago, the origin of the autism vaccines controversy, because kids tend to show their first signs of autism around the same time at which they're being vaccinated, and lots of parents attribute the autism symptoms to the vaccine taking. There's that example of tremendously horrible thinking by Osama, and this was one of his central pillars of his strategic thought, the other one being that America were a bunch of, you know, weak sissies and couldn't fight, had no stomach for a fight, and this he concluded after the Black Hawk Down incident in Somalia in 1992. So really, both the central pillars of his strategic thinking were deeply flawed, and it's just another illustration of why you shouldn't think badly even if you're a terrorist. But I suppose you wouldn't be a terrorist if you could think properly. But anyway.
Well, Osama bin Laden's death, of course, has also caused a whole lot of crazy people to come crawling out of the woodwork in their millions. And most notably, there's a psychic, a guy who calls himself Dr. Turi, predicted that someone famous may also meet a sad fate in the water. And he is therefore tying that up with Osama bin Laden's burial at sea. Never mind that it, you know, could mean anything, but he's now trumpeting that he could not have been more accurate. He nailed this one on the head, and therefore it is a win for him. So
that's just lame. I mean, someone famous, define famous for me. There are probably millions of people who could be understood as being famous, and then meet a sad end. Who's sad exactly about Osama's death? Not very many people.
Yeah, and at sea, that could mean anything. I mean, you could apply this prediction equally to if, say, one of the actors from the original Melrose Place died in a boating accident.
Or if some famous person drowned in his bath, because what this guy says is meet a sad fate in the water.
Right, yes.
And let's just also point out that a SEAL team shot and killed bin Laden in Abbottabad, Pakistan, which is not near the sea. He was buried at sea. So he didn't meet his fate at sea or near water. He was shot in a compound in Pakistan.
And then his corpse was tossed into the ocean. That's a different thing.
Yeah.
Even if his corpse had been carried back to the United States, for example, it would have crossed the ocean. So that still would have been
hit. Yeah, you're right.
Right. Anyway, so this guy also contacted the James Randi Educational Foundation. What's his name? Dr. Turi. Yeah. And he's claiming the $1 million prize. And seriously, this is pathetic. It's just preposterously vague, applies to far too many people. If someone had died in a tsunami, whatever. Or the other skepticism angle on the Osama bin Laden death story is that, as anyone should have expected, the conspiracy theorists have really come out swinging after his death. So it's a little bit probably too early to tell how this will pan out and what will become popular and what not. But the 9/11 conspiracy theorists, which, by the way, includes a big proportion of Muslims, I mean, an unfortunately large proportion of Muslims, don't believe bin Laden was actually guilty of perpetrating 9/11.
Even though he admitted it, right?
Yeah, he admitted it. But, you know, that it's supposed to be a Mossad plot. That's the conspiracy most popular among Muslims, is that Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency equivalent to the CIA, plotted the destruction of the Twin Towers. And, you know, there were no Jews at the Twin Towers when they went down.
Right.
Where were the Jews? And, you know, the conspiracy is that Israel wanted to draw America into the Middle East to serve its own geopolitical interests. And, I mean, there's just no evidence for that at all. And the 9/11 conspiracy nuts, the Western ones, tend to say, well, Osama's been dead all along. Either he was killed in Tora Bora in 2001, or he died of kidney failure in 2003, or he was killed in 2008 in a bombing raid, and now the Americans have just faked this latest killing. Some other conspiracy theories or that he's not dead at all, which seems... I don't think this is going to get very popular, especially since Al-Qaeda just released the statement admitting he was killed, and Osama could just counter this by appearing, you know, with a newspaper on a video.
Which is the sort of thing he's wanted to do. He loves that kind of attention.
Yes, he's done it before.
Right.
So there's one other thing I learned through Osama's death, and that is not to trust every source I would normally trust. My husband, Michael, posted a link to a picture of what he said on my Facebook was Osama bin Laden's corpse. It turned out it was a faked picture that had been faked 2 or 3 years ago, but because it came from Michael, I trusted my source and I was wrong. I thought it was Osama. It wasn't. So I learned a valuable lesson.
I knew it wasn't really him, but anyway.
It wasn't Goatsy or Lemon Pie or anything.
No, that grew old. I got Ange on those things too many times. By the way, if you don't know what Goatsy and Lemon Pie are, don't find out.
Yeah, please don't Google it.
Don't Google that. Yeah.
Trust us. This is the one thing you don't want to Google.
Yeah.
So that's our Osama news item, and I'm looking forward to the rest of 2011.
It can't get any more dramatic, can it?
Yeah.
Let's hope we've used up all our news now.
Well, some of the news has been good, like the Arab Spring, democracy sweeping the Middle East.
And confirmation of Einstein's theory of general relativity.
Yay! Tell us about that, Angela.
Right. Gravity Probe B, which is a NASA satellite, was launched in 2004 to study some of the predictions of Einstein's general theory of relativity. Just this week, we had results released which confirm two of the predictions of that theory. So, Gravity Probe B uses two ultra-precise gyroscopes to test the theory of general relativity. And what it confirmed was the warping of space-time around a gravitational body, which is called the geodetic effect. And it also confirmed frame dragging, which is the amount a spinning body drags space and time with it as it rotates. Gravity Probe B was placed in a polar orbiter and pointed at a single star, IM Pegasi. If gravity did not affect space-time, the probe's gyroscopes would have remained pointing in the same direction forever. But they actually recorded minute changes in direction as the Earth's gravity pulled at them. A great way to visualize this for yourself is to think of it as though the Earth was submerged in honey or some other viscous substance. As it spins, it sort of drags the honey with it and the honey starts to swirl around the planet. That's a good analogy of the effect that the planet has on space-time.
There is a science magazine feature on the satellite as well, which expressed some serious doubts about the results and the significance of Gravity Probe B. Now, it's a $760 million satellite, but in 2004, two researchers at the University of Maryland had already published results on the frame dragging effect. So they confirmed it already in 2004, and all they did is they very carefully tracked the orbits of two simple satellites launched in the 1970s and 80s. So at least part of these results have already been established. And the other problem that this article mentions is that there were problems with the gyroscopes. Can't pretend to understand the technical details, but the upshot is that they weren't as accurate as predicted, and the researchers as a consequence had to do all sorts of statistical corrections in their results. And at least some scientists are worried that these corrections weren't done properly, and the uncertainty in their data has reduced so dramatically that some scientists are saying, well, there might be a bit of a problem here. So all in all, this satellite, its thunder was stolen a bit by a far simpler technique, and there seems to be problems in its methodology and its design. So we're going to have to wait and see whether these results actually stand up to scrutiny.
This doesn't mean that Einstein's theory of general relativity is invalid. It just means that this particular experiment is not as important as one might think.
Okay, so moving on from gravity to homeopathy. Now, I must say that there are few things that I really, really get up in arms about, but this following story really angers me tremendously. So there are homeopaths working with AIDS patients in the specific story is from Kenya, and it's just mind-bogglingly evil what these people are doing. A undercover journalist working for a Kenyan newspaper went to go speak to a practitioner working for the Abba Light Foundation, which, by the way, is funded by West Christian charities, indirectly, very indirectly, also by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And this practitioner told this undercover journalist, asking on the behalf of a HIV-positive relative what should be done. And this person told the journalist that they might be able to stop taking antiretroviral drugs once they had started to take homeopathic preparations.
The level of irresponsibility in that man's statement is just unbelievable. It makes my stomach turn.
To understand why we are so up in arms about this particular story, a little bit of a background on homeopathy. So homeopathy is an alternative medical practice invented by the German Samuel Hahnemann in the 18th century, who came up with two homeopathic principles. I won't go as far as to call them laws. The first is what he called the law of similars.
The law of similars is when you have a preparation that will induce symptoms in a healthy patient. For example, you have a healthy patient who isn't experiencing any complaints. If you give them an intervention, it will induce those symptoms. So, for example, a healthy patient sleeping well, you give them caffeine and it will induce insomnia. Then when somebody comes in who is an ill patient, somebody who is presenting insomnia on their own, the assumption is that if you give them caffeine, it will cure them of that. The basis for this assumption is a mystery.
He sucked it out of his tongue.
Right, he made it up completely.
And the second is the law of infinitesimals, or the principle of infinitesimals. And that's the idea that the less there is of any substance in a preparation, as long as it's magically shaken in between, the more potent it becomes. So the idea is you take the caffeine that's going to make you sleep, and you dilute it 1 in 10, and then you take that preparation and you dilute that 1 in 10 again. And you do that 30 times. And that's for most homeopathic preparations. 30C is what is recommended. And the slight problem with this is it conflicts with a fundamental law of physics and chemistry known as Avogadro's constant, which to engage in a bit of argument from authority, Albert Einstein spent his PhD empirically determining the value of Avogadro's constant. He contributed to that.
Quite a guy, that guy.
Seriously, it's getting old. And the problem is there's this thing called the dose-response relationship. And generally speaking, there is a graph you can draw that generally means the more you give of a substance, the bigger the response, the less of a substance, the less of a response. And what homeopathy advocates is that you dilute a substance so much that not only is there nothing of the original left, so if you take that caffeine and do it to 30C and you suss it every time, you shake it up and down magically. And if you do that 30 times, there's nothing of the original caffeine left. In fact, there's likely to be no water molecule in that substance that even came into contact with the original substance.
But at that point, you're more likely to have a caffeine molecule that came in from the outside than one is left over from the original preparation.
So homeopathy is pure magical thinking. It's an example of a medical practice that is ruled out by the laws of physics.
Yeah, it completely contradicts all of the laws of physics as we know and understand them today.
So it's unlike something else like, say, reflexology or acupuncture, which is also quite implausible, but not nearly as implausible as homeopathy, because there's no fundamental law of physics that says piercing the skin will cure you, right? There's no law ruling that out. But there is an actual law established beyond all reasonable doubt that homeopathy cannot work.
To be fair, not all homeopaths subscribe to the law of infinitesimals. There is a growing movement within the practice of homeopathy where they acknowledge that there's this physical limitation, and once you go past a certain dilution, there's a very little chance that it'll work. Although the ones who don't subscribe to the law of infinitesimals tend not to be all that vocal about it, and the fact remains that it's still a fundamental principle of homeopathy as introduced by Samuel Hahnemann. All that means is that there's an inconsistency standard of care even within homeopathy.
And they're still subscribed to the like cures like, which is magical thinking.
Right. There's no basis to believe that that's real.
One of the funniest things that I've heard someone describe homeopathy as, it's like you drop your car keys in a river, walk 100 meters downstream, take a cup of water out of the river and try and start your car with a cup of water. That pretty much sums up homeopathy.
That's about right.
So not only does homeopathy contradict known physics and chemistry. Despite this fact, various clinical trials have been conducted on homeopathy, and all the best evidence indicates that it works for nothing, as you would expect. So we have the physical laws of chemistry ruling it out, and then we have disconfirming evidence from actual clinical trials.
What it does have going for it, though, is the placebo effect, which is great.
As long as you have a minor or a fairly minor or a psychogenic disease or malady, then the placebo effect can help you. It's a misunderstanding to think there's a placebo effect for cancer. But, I mean, there is none. There is for your subjective experience of the pain of cancer, for example, but there's no placebo effect for the malignant cells in your body going down or being reduced if you take a placebo.
As the saying goes, an untreated cold will get better on its own in 7 days, but if you take a homeopathic remedy, it'll get better in a week.
Yeah, great. So now we understand exactly why we are ragging on people who are trying to give patients suffering from serious medical diseases homeopathy to treat things like AIDS.
Right, homeopathy is not a substitute for actual medicine.
Yes, it's not, and it's highly irresponsible for the Abba Light Foundation to be recommending that people use it. And they're not just doing it in Kenya, they also recommend that in Tanzania they are trying to give people homeopathic treatments for malaria, which is a deadly disease that kills millions of people every year in this continent, and they need to be stopped.
The despicable thing about this for me is the angle that they're using to promote this in Kenya in particular is on the price angle, because now antiretrovirals are expensive. Yep. More than half the citizens of Kenya live below the poverty line, so they don't have access to antiretrovirals because they simply can't afford it. So now this Abba Light Foundation comes in and offers their noxious potions, or not so noxious potions, at a fraction of the cost, and convince these people that they're getting medicine, when in fact that's not the case. And then they train the locals on how to produce homeopathic preparations as if they're training doctors.
They've also brought up the side effects issue. People don't want to take the antiretrovirals because they have severe side effects, whereas homeopathy has no side effects. And what do we say about something that has no side effects? It has no real effects either.
So really, homeopathy in the Western world, as long as it's restricted to the worried well who, you know, want to feel like they're doing something, fine. Go ahead, I don't care. But come to Africa and take advantage of people who aren't necessarily particularly well educated, who don't have any alternatives, and there are charities promoting this. You can take your Western nonsense and shove it up your ass. Seriously, fuck off.
All right, so going from nuts in Kenya to Nutcracker Man in Kenya.
Good one.
Very nice.
Nutcracker Man, turns out, did not crack nuts. The Nutcracker Man is a nickname for an early human species called Paranthropus boisei, which is an extinct hominan species belonging to the Paranthropus genus.
Well done, hominan.
Thank you. Paranthropus are robust australopithecines, so australopithecines are early hominans, and Paranthropus are a subgenus of Australopithecus that are robust. That means that they tend to have larger, more rugged features. And P. boisei was discovered by Mary Leakey at Olduvai Gorge in Tanzania. And Tanzania, you might remember, is a large East African country just south of Kenya. And Olduvai Gorge is in the north of the country near the Serengeti National Park. Right, so Paranthropus boisei, we'll just call him boisei, is generally referred to Nutcracker Man because he has a very powerful jaw. It was generally assumed that boisei lived on a diet of things like nuts, seeds, and hard fruit that needed a lot of jaw power in order to consume. But some recent reanalysis of the examples that we have, I think we have about 27 samples of boisei, have cast some doubt on that. Now, the initial doubt that was cast on it was an examination of the carbon content of the skeletons, which tells us, and Michael will go into some detail about how it tells us that, it was most likely that boisei didn't eat nuts and fruit and that sort of thing, but probably ate grass.
Hmm,
and that has to do with the different isotopes of carbon that are found in the remains.
Was that ate grass predominantly or only?
Predominantly. Okay. It seems likely that heavy jaw would have helped them eat nuts and fruit and that sort of thing if grass wasn't available, so as a fallback food. But their staple diet was probably grass.
So there are different types of photosynthesis. So there are a couple of different roots. And so-called C4 plants, which are mostly grasses, they incorporate more carbon-13 than other plants into the matter that constitutes them. So carbon-13 13 is an isotope of carbon. So it's a specific type of carbon. The other one is carbon 12. And because we use the matter of the things we eat to build our own bodies, you can usually tell quite a lot about what some living organism eats by what it is made up of. So because the teeth of this P. bozii skeleton contain far more carbon 13 than 12, it suggests that P. bozii ate mostly grasses instead of nuts, which uses a different photosynthesis pathway.
This was published by Theorist Serling and colleagues in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, PNAS, journal. And this has lent some support to some earlier findings that were published in PLOS One, the Public Libraries of Science One journal, a couple of years ago, back in 2008, by Peter Ungar and colleagues, which looked at dental microware on the specimens. So what they did was they looked at the teeth on the specimens that were available under a microscope, and they looked at the little fissures and scrapes and abrasions and that sort of thing that were on the surface of the teeth, and they found it to be consistent with that of animals today that are known to eat grasses. So things like cows in particular had similar kinds of dental microware. So what we have here is two different lines of evidence, both pointing in the same direction, that bozii probably ate grassy foods primarily, and has largely debunked the whole nutcracker man idea.
And that probably means the P. bozii's gut microflora would have been quite different from all other hominins, which suggests a completely different evolutionary line. So it's a radical change in its diet, and as I understand it, to eat grasses, that the tough fibers and so on need to be broken down by specific bacteria. So it'll be interesting to find out, though I doubt we will be able to, how different this gut microflora would have been. It's the human cow.
Indeed.
that's what the media is calling it. To be clear, it didn't just eat grass. It just ate predominantly grass. So, right. So it did probably eat some nuts.
Right, and because it had this big, powerful jaw, it would have been able to chew through the shells of hard nuts and hard fruit and that kind of stuff, if it needed to, if grass was in short supply.
I wonder if it ate meat. Did it become a straight herbivore, or was it still an omnivore?
Interesting. As far as I can tell, it seems to have been a straight herbivore, but who knows, it may well have been able to eat as well if it wanted to.
Although lots of herbivores do eat meat when it's available, or at least some, like hippos, will consume carcasses.
Can I give you some background information on another primate that eats grass?
Do it.
Just because it's interesting. So there's a primate called Therapithecus gelada, which is the last species of the dynasty of grass-grazing primates. They used to range throughout Africa and into India, but are now only found in the grasslands of north and central Ethiopia.
Right, but this isn't a hominin or a hominin. This is now
this is a primate.
It's a primate. So it's a baboon or a monkey or of some sort.
It's a gelada. So the geladas are creatures of the mountaintops. They don't range through forests or grasslands like most African primates. They wander through high meadows.
So eating grass isn't a unique adaptation to P. bozii, but it is a fairly rare adaptation for primates in general, it seems.
And we can file this also under, it's always more complicated than you think.
Indeed.
Yeah. So moving on, what were we talking about again? Something about...
I don't know.
What's that?
I lost my train of thought.
I haven't been following anything. What are we doing here today? What day is it?
Anyway, that's a segue for the segment on easily distracted people having too much brain. Owen, what the hell?
Well, I'm an easily distracted sort of person, and I've always assumed that it was because my brain was too big.
That's actually your big head.
It's big because it's full of brains. A study by Ryota Kanai at University College London seems to have confirmed my suspicion. Ryota and colleagues have found a correlation between distractibility and higher than average amount of gray matter in the left superior parietal lobe. So the left superior parietal lobe is a part of the brain. It's kind of on top of your head and a little bit to the back, right? So that's where it sits. And what they found is that people who are more distractible have an excess of gray matter in this region of the brain. So to put this to the test, they subjected some people to a procedure called transcranial magnetic stimulation, which allows them to kind of switch off small areas of the brain. That's an oversimplification, but that's kind of what they're doing.
And it dampens the activity in particular areas of the brain.
Right.
It can be very specified, narrowly focused.
Yeah, so what they've done is, in these test subjects, they dampened the function of this super parietal parietal lobe. We'll just call it the SPL. and found that these people took longer to perform specific tasks, up to 25% longer to perform a task. Their fundamental assumption there, of course, being that distractibility is what's making them take longer to perform these tasks. So now what they're suggesting is the cause for this distractibility is that this extra gray matter is it represents an immaturity in the brain. So what happens is that during development, the brain sets up a lot of neurons, and then those neurons are kind of culled during life, and they become more efficient and better at processing information as you develop, and the amount of gray matter actually decreases over time because your brain is just getting better and better. So in these people that have this extra gray matter, for some reason they have this developmental anomaly which has diminished the amount of optimization that's occurred during their lives.
Cool. This research seems fairly preliminary still, but still fascinating. I didn't read the original study itself, but as far as I can tell, it was well done.
Yes, indeed.
What we're going to do now is we're going to move on from being distractible to being a little bit depressed.
We've discussed in the last couple of weeks the pharmaceutical industry and its regulation, and we have come out to some extent defending the pharmaceutical industry against conspiracy claims that, you know, they're just out to make a buck and nothing they do actually work, and they're there to suppress, you know, alternative modalities that actually work and so on. All that is nonsense, but it's important to take a nuanced position. You don't have to choose between full-on support, you know, yay pharmaceutical industry, and boo down with the pharmaceutical industry. There's a middle course which I think is the rational one, and that is to say, when the pharmaceutical industry does good stuff, we support them, and then when they do bad stuff, we don't support them. And we've given several examples of large pharmaceutical firms doing good things, you know, developing vaccines, selling these vaccines, saving lots of lives. Some of the time, however, they do naughty things. So here's a specific news story about a pharmaceutical company behaving badly. Now, a 2001 paper in the Journal of American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry concluded that an antidepressant manufactured by the company GlaxoSmithKline called paroxetine is, quote, generally well tolerated and effective, unquote, for treatment of major depression in adolescents. However, they engaged in all sorts of statistical naughtiness in this particular study. How clinical trials work is to prevent people from fishing in data and finding illusory results. You have to establish beforehand what your outcome measures are going to be. So if I want to test my hypothesis that eating lots of grass is going to cure my stomach problems, I need to set out beforehand what I'm going to measure and what counts as success in this particular study. So in a case of depression, you'll say, for example, a 20 or 30% improvement in a particular index of depression counts as a successful drug, and you do this before you actually conduct the trial. And if you don't do this, it's very easy to go look in the data and look around and fish in the data and then find a tiny little thing that works somehow. If you exclude this and exclude that, count it as a success even if it wasn't. And what GlaxoSmithKline does is that they introduced four new secondary outcome measures, and only these measures actually showed a benefit in the depression score. There were actually 15 other new secondary outcome measures introduced as well, and all these failed to show an improvement. So they introduced 19 new outcome measurements, discovered four of them quite possibly or almost certainly just by chance happened to show positive results, and it turned out that these showed positive, but it's actually just a result due to a statistical fluke.
These are benchmarks which they introduced after the trials were done. So it's basically looking back and saying, right, how can we make this look better?
Sure, it's cheating, essentially. If you change your outcome measure after you've done your trial and after you've looked at the data, you're not blinded to the data. Therefore, it's cheating. And in fact, internal documents obtained from GlaxoSmithKline shows that several employees and the marketing department were convinced this drug didn't show any efficacy. So GlaxoSmithKline was behaving rather badly. And the second part of the story is that one of the authors of the study, I use the word author here advisedly, he's shown as an author, but apparently, according to a blog that I will link to, the study was actually ghost written by someone paid to do so. And this person is called Tim Bosquet, and I'm not sure I'm saying that correctly. It's probably from one of those French-Canadian names. It's B-O-U-S-Q-U-E-T. And he ran in the recent Canadian election. And what happened is a journalist for the Canadian newspaper, The Coast, ran an article on Tim's involvement in this dodgy study, and The Coast was then threatened with legal action, with libel, for publishing this article. And unfortunately, The Coast folded and decided to withdraw this article. So you have a dodgy study, and then, you know, using legal threats to prevent the publication of information about this case. So it really does not look good. To be clear, it doesn't look like GlaxoSmithKline or the ones who sued the newspaper. It was Tim Bosquet's lawyers.
Now, this looks like yet another example of the funding bias in medical research, where it tends to be the case that when a pharmaceutical company is funding a trial into a particular intervention that they happen to sell, more often than not, those results will come in positive.
I believe the figure is about it's four times as likely to be reported as positive compared to when it's funded by an independent organization of some kind, or if it's done by independent academics.
Right. So, and because these studies are owned by the pharmaceutical companies, they're not necessarily part of the public record. So we as the general public don't necessarily have visibility into how it is that those results become positive. It could be because the researchers involved just have a subconscious bias, or it could be that there is this kind of statistical naughtiness going on where they're deriving results out of the data that they weren't looking for when they embarked upon the research and that sort of thing. And that's probably another example of something that's wrong in science that needs to be fixed a bit.
What I find quite amusing is the fact that the lady who writes this blog, Alison Bass, she's questioning, you know, the efficacy of these drugs because of the statistical anomalies in the trial. And she's been accused of being a Scientologist. For any of our listeners who are not familiar with Scientology, it is a made-up religion written by...
Like all other religions.
Well, I mean, but this one is particularly egregious because we know it was made up about 40 years ago by L. Ron Hubbard. He wrote a ludicrous science fiction story which has now somehow become some sort of religion with a lot of very famous followers. And they believe that all mental illness is caused by... I feel silly saying it. It's caused by the spirits of dead aliens that are haunting our brains. Okay?
That's very well put.
Thank you. So they believe that you shouldn't take any psychotropic drugs or any drugs which might treat you for things like depression or psychosis because you're not treating the real problem. You should rather go to a Scientologist and have yourself read on their stupid e-meter.
Exorcised, really.
Yes. And then try and align your whatevers that they do, which is just ludicrous. So these guys are now saying that anyone who is questioning these drugs is a Scientologist.
Which is a clever tactic. Clearly disingenuous in this case and probably others. Unfortunately, the Scientologists do dodgy things and they hide behind various organizations that don't seem to be Scientology related but actually are a front organization for Scientology. But it's clearly poisoning the well. Even if Alison Bass was a Scientologist, this doesn't mean that she's wrong. That would just be an ad hominem attack. She could be both right and a Scientologist, unlikely as it may seem. So, yeah, it's a clever tactic.
I have an ethical question for you, Michael, because you probably know more about this than either Owen or I. Is it ethical, is it allowed for a ghost writer to write a study and then have other people sign off as being the author?
It's generally frowned upon, to put it mildly. It is a practice that is done, but especially in scientific research, you really need to specify very clearly what the various contributions are. And what a couple of journals do, or many journals are now starting to do, is to lay out specifically what the authors of any given paper actually contributed to the study. So you see, for example, you know, Bob designed the study, James, Bob, and Tabu wrote up the study, and Kate and Sue worked together to do the statistical analysis. So it's generally not a good thing, but it's not fraud or anything like that, except perhaps if you're claiming to be in your academic institution, if you're claiming this as credit, because of course the main plus next to your name when it comes to promotions and that kind of things is where you've published and what you've published and how often you've published. So if you're claiming a study that you didn't actually write, design, or analyze, dies, then that is a bit of a problem.
I imagine people probably do it as a way of obtaining credibility. Like if you're a relatively unknown person in your field, you might decide to approach somebody who's well respected in your field and get them to sign off on your research, thus lending your research that much more credibility. Even if they weren't involved in the actual research, they might read through it and agree with what you've seen.
Hi, I'm Carl Zimmer from The Loom, and you're listening to Consilience.
So, we have a new short feature this week. For a bit of background, every month for the last couple of years, I have curated, as it were, the African Skepticism Rationalist and Science blog roll. And what this is just a list of active blogs by Africans or about Africa that has a scientific, a rationalist, a skeptical angle to them, at least some of the time. And I think every month or so, we'll take one blog from this list that I've compiled. And if you know of any African science or skepticism blogs that are not included in the list, please email me at michael.meaden@gmail.com. I'm constantly looking for new blogs to add. The more the merrier. And what we'll do every month or so is we'll highlight one of the blogs on this list. Now, our first blog is Quackdown, which is a cleverly named blog run by Nathan Gaffin, who works for the Treatment Action Campaign, which is an excellent non-governmental organization based in South Africa that advocates on issues surrounding HIV and AIDS. And they've been at the forefront of combating AIDS quackery. If you'll probably recall that South Africa's second democratically elected president, Thabo Mbeki, was an AIDS denialist, and the leader of the TAC, Zaki Ahmed, and Nathan Gaffin and a whole bunch of other people in the TAC were at the forefront of combating this nonsense that eventually resulted in the deaths of 300,000 people, unfortunately. Early unnecessary deaths of 300,000 people.
Quackdown, with the little slogan, helping you make informed choices about healthcare, can be found at quackdown.tac.org.za. We'll also include a link to the show notes. And they publish articles or blog posts by various people, including Gaffin himself and Marcus Lowe and other people, and I highly recommend it. There are articles about whether you should get vaccinated against the flu, you know, problems in South Africa's advertising standards authority, and so on and so forth. And it really is probably the single best resource on medical news in South Africa that I know of at the moment.
Excellent.
Thanks, Mike. All right, we have two announcements this week. First up is Skeptics in the Pub Durban. It's happening on Thursday, the 19th of May. As usual, it's happening at Pitsetta in Davenport Road, and it starts at 6 p.m. The second one is Skeptics in the Pub Pretoria, which is happening 2 days later on Saturday, the 21st of May, and that's happening at Braza at Irene Mall, and that's at 12:30 in the afternoon, so it's lunchtime. Details may still change on that one, so keep an eye on the Facebook page. We'll link to it in the show notes, but for now, that's where it's going to be.
Cool. Right.
All right, that's all we have for you this week. Angela, where can people find you on the internet?
I'm not on the internet.
Oh, all right.
I'm in the internet.
You are the internet.
If you desperately want to see the things I do on the internet, you can check me out at skepticdetective.wordpress.com, or you can follow me on Twitter, Angela Meaden.
And Michael, where can people find you?
I'm Michael Meaden, one word on Twitter, and Ionian Enchantment, a beautiful, wonderful blog full of insight and mystery and adventure, which I hardly ever update. But anyway, check it out.
Excellent. And you can find me and all of my things at owenswat.org. You'll find my Twitter and my Facebook and my blogs and that sort of thing there.
That's all we have for you this week, folks. Until next time.
This is the Skeptic's Guide. I got distracted. My brain is too big. Damn it. All right. Cheers, guys.
Be sure to join us again next week for more Consilience.
Listening to Consilience. Our website is consiliencecast.wordpress.com, and you can send us an email to consiliencecast@gmail.com. Theme music is The Optimist by Zoe Keating from freemusicarchive.org.
Okay, I have something important to say, but I can't open the damn thing because this browser sucks ass.
What
fucking Firefox.